Thad Potters, we're back. Another That's a Dive midweek edition. Thank you for tuning in again. Thank you for your reviews. Keep the reviews coming. So the last one I asked for you to send, we've gone away from, and I've got producer Jorge in here. PJ, we've gone away from the stadium. Which stadium do you want to go see a game in? Mm-hmm. Because the handball situation is starting to get a bit crazy. It's becoming our what's a catch in NFL.
Yeah.
Which I'm not going to pretend to understand any of that because I don't watch American football a lot. So this comes from Colo Blanco. And what I want is a review and what you guys think the handball rule should be to get rid of gray area. And this was his suggestion. So my change to the handball rule would be keep it plain and simple. Any handball away from the body should be an indirect free kick from where it occurred, even in the penalty box. This would be similar to dangerous play without contact fouls. This would eliminate the gray areas with the current rule and revive the indirect free kick that is a rare occurrence in the game today. On paper, it makes the rule black and white. Can I say for a second, I kind of like this. I mentioned
really?
This to Musto. So one second. Okay. I've got an addendum.
I've got some.
First, I think we need to accept there is no one perfect, flawless handball rule. There is no world, there's no panacea where we find the solution and everyone's satisfied with it. But I think the big problem with the current rule, and now the problem with the IFAB, and they've made a change to many rules, and the handball rule is one they tackled. It's almost worse now than it was before. So
you think it's more confusing?
Yeah, I mean, it's not less confusing. Mm-hmm. So the confusion with the handball rule was, is it deliberate or not?
Yep.
So that was in there. And now they've taken deliberate out. But deliberate was given, especially as a player, and then as a former player where you're thinking, you know, the majority of handballs called are accidental. I mean, you're not intending to touch the ball on these deflections. And so they had to put in all of these other qualifications, you know, the proximity of the player kicking it to you, how short does it travel, how fast does it go, you know, and all of this stuff that created almost a entire rule book for one rule to try and figure out what is a handball and what isn't. And it's in the box that creates a huge problem. It's when the consequence is a penalty, everyone's going to be struggling with it because, you know, it's a low-scoring game, and that makes it beautiful. The margins are small. Scoring a goal is the crescendo and you know, confluence of many great plays or bonehead moments. It's just this ebb and flow that builds to this incredible explosion of joy. You can't give someone a free shot right in front of the goal, dead center, from just over 10 yards away, and say, go for it, because some guy was jumping in the air and his hand, as it naturally does, moves away from his body. And when you shot the ball, it hit it and he had absolutely no chance to move it. Too many of those get called, and it ruins the integrity of the game. So the good part about this rule is the biggest area that's a problem is in the box. So the game is refereed differently in the box, even though the rules aren't different.
Yep.
We know it. For instance, if you get a shot off and get absolutely clobbered, you are not getting a penalty. It almost never, ever happens, and it shouldn't, because you got your attempt on goal, and you shouldn't get another one of those.
Well, we just saw, I was going to say, in the Newcastle game today, it wasn't a shot, but DeAndre Yedlin was making a cross and gets tripped up after the cross happened.
Yeah.
And we debated that, Daniels might have gotten a bit of the ball on it too, but that goes to your point that because he'd gotten the cross off already, it's kind of, the play's already passed.
Yeah, you and listen, someone getting ready to slide in and crush you does change you a little bit. You don't maybe get as much purchase on the ball. You don't get the spin you wanted. But it's just, we've accepted that a foul at midfield is not judged the same as a foul in the box. Mm-hmm. Even though everyone wants to live by the letter of the law, that's how the game's refereed. And it's refereed that way because it would ruin the sport if the tiny little fouls called around the field were given so someone could easily accomplish what should be very difficult to accomplish, which is score a goal, right? So let's change the rule for inside the box for handball. Everywhere else, and this guy is saying all over the field, right? Indirect kick all over the field when it's a handball. But what I love about his rule is you don't have to differentiate. It doesn't have to be distinctive of out there, out here. But the next piece is, listen, if someone intentionally does that, If you intentionally, and here's what's hard is we're judging intent. Mm-hmm. But I think natural body position and all these other things, like the new phrase, right? The new part of the rule is your arm outside of the natural silhouette of your body. Yeah. Here's the thing. Are you making yourself bigger? Well, hold on a second. Your arms don't change in size. So when I move my arm away from next to my body, it leaves an arm, hole next to me, a hole the shape of an arm right next to me, and puts my arm in a different location. I mean, remember Da Vinci's, sketch of the band? Anywhere I put my arm, my body's still the same size. So essentially you're saying, am I trying to put my arms out in this area to block a ball intentionally? Don't try to judge whether someone's doing that or not, because your arms naturally move away from your body. So if you're concerned about the silhouette of your body, and by making yourself bigger, you mean we want your arms essentially to disappear, then the language should be, make sure that your arms are within the silhouette of your body. Because the second you say outside, they start outside. The natural position of my arms is outside the silhouette of my body frame. And then they can go to many natural positions that are outside my body frame. None of them make me bigger, by the way. So I have a difficulty with that. So I just say, in the box, indirect free kick. Now we got to talk about, like, what about Luis Suarez in the World Cup,
that was
right,
the big
with Uruguay, and saves the ball on the line. I just think you can move on to say, if it's done in a obvious way to stop a goal scoring opportunity, then you get a red card and an indirect free kick.
So you wouldn't give a penalty in that case?
Well,
Suarez example.
I mean, it's one or the other. I don't think you do both. Just like they've changed. We don't want the double jeopardy thing, right? So it's kind of we have to determine, and maybe you can choose. That'd be brilliant. What if you could choose?
Depending on the game,
if it's the fourth minute, I want to be a man up. Mm-hmm. If it's the 94th minute, I want the penalty. Yeah. So
it's kind of like declining a penalty in football.
Dramatic little thing. But anyway, I like the idea. Anything that legislates for inside the box, where the consequence of a handball isn't a penalty kick, I'm with anything like that. That's getting close to how I want to see handball, because we're not moaning about the handball at midfield. Mm-hmm. You know, it's okay for there to be accidental handballs called all over there. But an accidental handball, and the current rule is going to still have accidental handballs called, should not mean a penalty kick.
What if not quite as bad as Suarez batting the ball down off the line? Let's say you're a defender and you're right on the edge of the box and you're out on the wing more. And somebody sent you, the player you're marking is going to send a cross in. And you just decide to start making your arms big, either make them wider or you can even put them high. And you're just basically intentionally, you almost become like a second goalie.
Yeah.
Where you know now you're not going to get called for a penalty kick, where you're just basically going to start using your hands. Because let's just say there's a big center forward in the middle that's very good at headers. You're better off just blocking it with your hand and denying that cross. Could you have situations like that start arising where defenders start to be clever, where they can use their hands, and all the only sacrifice is an indirect free kick, or those types of cases could be they could have harsher penalties, I guess, like you're saying here, like a red card for
I think you can put in language that's not about natural and intent and deliberate and all this, and you can say a exaggerated arm movement not consistent with your athletic move is always a yellow card if the ball hits your hand. Because here's the thing, if you know that, then you're not going to defend with your arms way out like that, right? Mm-hmm. So I just think you can legislate for that area. That's not the area we're worried about. I think we can live in the world where handballs aren't and they're called outside of the box. It's just we have to fix the world of it changes games when it's inside the box. Mm-hmm. So I just think inside the box, It should be, and listen, you have two boxes. Listen, the 6-yard box is used for basically nothing. It's used a few times a game to put the ball on it, and now you don't even have to put the ball on. You can put the ball wherever. Mm-hmm. And so maybe within the 6-yard box, the rule gets even more harsh. You know, maybe if the ball hits your hand within the 6-yard box,
that's a penalty.
Where it's away from your body, your torso, your body line,
your silhouette.
Yeah, so that I'm okay with. So if you're in the 6-yard box and the ball hits your hand on its way to goal, and you're inside the 6-yard box, it's a penalty.
Okay.
And so, because here's the other thing I don't like is what if I slide on the ground to go block your cross and you cut it back and I'm in the 6-yard box and it rolls over my arm? Mm-hmm. You shouldn't get a penalty for that.
Yeah.
So I think, listen, they already judge, is it on target with goals, right?
Like if it's an own goal.
Yeah, if it's
like
an own,
that,
if
it deflects.
If you shoot and it's not on target and it goes off of someone in, they're going to make that, more often than not, that's an own goal that mm-hmm. they're not going to give you, right?
Yeah.
You can judge, especially with VAR now, if a ball is heading onto the frame of the goal. If it is, and you're inside the 6-yard mm-hmm. box, and it hits your arm, when it's away from the silhouette of your body, then it's a penalty, right? And then if it's egregious, if it's over-exaggerated, it's a penalty and a red card.
And a red card.
But everything else outside there, indirect, I mean, it's just...
I think when you get more specific like that, I think... Because I do think there needs to be room where you can... Like very obvious handballs are worthy of a penalty kick for the opposition.
Yeah,
I mean, I think you need some...
But it's like not about where you're. It's not about the positioning of your arm, because my arms can naturally be above my head or out wide. There needs to be language that doesn't say natural.
Yeah.
No, because when you jump, your arms. When you spin, when you move, when you kick, your arms come away from your body. It's got to be about an obvious and exaggerated movement of your arms away from your body to increase the likelihood the ball hits it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, something like that.
Okay.
We're getting there. Although now our rule is like 12 pages long.
I just want to point out, he's one of the reasons they wanted, Colo Blanco wanted this, is they said they want to revive the indirect free kick. Does the indirect free kick need to be revived?
Is it in jeopardy? Do we just save the indirect free kick?
I know, that's what I'm wondering. Is that something in our life, in our lives that
I don't miss it. You know what's funny is we still go through the motion of indirect free kicks, even though he wants to revive it.
Yeah.
To give yourself just better angles, better timing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as worried about getting the free kick back, but it's a great maybe consolation.
Yeah.
Getting the indirect free kick back. But let's turn from a fun and kind of joking matter to a really serious matter that I want to make sure. And when we were trying to figure out what to do, PJ, this week, mm-hmm. we thought, let's dedicate an entire show after we debate handball for too long. Mm-hmm. Let's dedicate an entire show to what's going on in the world of U.S. soccer, and specifically a recent suit that was filed by the U.S. women's national team. It's a new equal pay lawsuit versus U.S. soccer. And so this claim and the disparity of pay and the inequality of treatment is nothing new, but this is a new lawsuit. And it was done on International Women's Day. And it's a multi-year legal fight over pay equity for U.S. women's soccer players. So some of the high-profile names that came forward in this suit when it was filed, Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe, Becky Sauerbrunn, and there's 25 other players on the U.S. women's national team that sued the U.S. Soccer Federation in federal court. This coming off the back of U.S. Soccer Foundation, which is not a part of U.S. Soccer, which actually kind of gets to the crux of the situation there, also in the past few months sued U.S. Soccer over a trademark claim. And we won't spend time on that, but just to sort of put in context that there is a lot going on in the world of U.S. soccer, and it's important to get to the crux of this claim, because I'm going to try my best to not put too much opinion and too much emotion into this, but it's impossible, because I feel strongly that the U.S. women's national team is not treated fairly, is not treated equally. And I'll take it a step further. deserves equal pay. So the claim is not about the men get a dollar, we want a dollar. The claim is complex, and there's many different layers to this, and it's actually two different laws that are referenced. There is the Equal Pay Act. So that became law in 1963, and it prohibits employers from wage discrimination on the basis of sex. So that is a challenge to compensation, if you were to simplify it, and it's more complex than that. But essentially, that would be there are employees making this, and we are making less based on our gender, to try and find some distinction here. And then the next one is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And that takes it even further to go outside of the realm of discrimination that is linked to compensation. And it's about, other things that can be measured to prove the U.S. women's national team is not being treated the same, supported the same, promoted the same, and set up for success the same as the men's side. So when I go that step further to say, I think they deserve the dollar that the men get, and anyone who wears that crest and represents their country and goes out on the field, and the women have been doing it for years at an incredible level, making us so proud to cheer them on, to wear their jersey, to support them, and they go around the world and show that we are the best in the world. And when I grew up, Mia Hamm was one of my heroes. I wanted to be Mia Hamm, just like I wanted to be Michael Jordan, just like I wanted to be Eddie Vedder, and just like I wanted to be Zinedine Zidane. And so I have a daughter, and I shouldn't need to have a daughter to want my kids to grow up in a world where the opportunities are there for my son, just like they are for my daughter. And so when I say I think they should get a dollar and the men should get a dollar, that's kind of moving further than the claim. The claim is saying they deserve to be supported and compensated fairly and equitably. And their claim is that they're not. And one of the reasons when I ran for U.S. soccer president, I made sure that I found three words early on when I sat with my incredible team that took time out of their lives to go with me on this crazy journey. And all of them just so supportive and talented in different ways. And we sat and we thought, what do I care about? And we went through this important discussion where I asked everyone what they care about and how do we deconstruct the problems within our soccer landscape and come up with a platform where we clearly say what we stand for, what are our principles, what would I do if I was in office, and then go even further and create a very long document called Our Progress Plan that line by line went through how I would attack all of these problems. How would I improve these issues of consequence? And the three words we came up with were transparency, equality, and progress. And when I said equality, it was about feeling equal in a locker room for a team, all the way to feeling equal as an employee of a federation and as a representative of your country when you step on the grass and play this beautiful game of soccer. And so I just want to try and find that demarcation point where now my personal feeling and an emotion of I did interviews and in my progress plan spoke a lot about I want to push for the women to make the same amount of money as the men. And by the way, the men, the majority of them feel this way too. And their players union came forward and said, we fully support what's going on. And, USA Water Polo is an example of a vanguard going forward and paying their men and women the same. There are nations that are starting to come forward and pay their women's soccer team the same that they pay their men's. And I just think we should be leaders in this area and go a step further. you know, fair and equitable is tough to accomplish. So instead of tiptoeing towards that, let's jump past it and force everyone to have to speed up. And I just, you know, that's how I felt. And that's what I believe in. But let me just digress from that for a second and get to the crux of what this situation is. The players, and there's a potential that this turns into a class action suit that extends further than the 28 players in this case right now. But for right now, players have come forward and said there are myriad examples of us not being treated the same as the male players. And when you do the calculus of many different things that are linked to when you try and encapsulate and explain the U.S. women's national team, one of the things you talk about is incredible success and World Cup winners and world-class players and champions. And so part of it is also, you know, linking this feeling of undervalued, undersupported, and the inequitable world that they're in to they don't think the compensation, the support, the treatment is commensurate with their level of success. So, you know, as you go through some of these things, if I try to drill down, PJ, and get a little more specific, there is a pay disparity that can be, and it's complicated because some of the accounting for revenue coming in, and we dealt with this, and this is outside of the equality part of this. Some of the revenue generated by U.S. soccer, because of the business structure that's set up, it's so opaque that it's very difficult to understand the distribution. It's hard to understand if assets are getting market value, and then what happens when that revenue comes into the U.S. soccer bucket, and what happens at that point. And you know, there is, in terms of a pay disparity, a claim that the women earn 38% of what the men earn for the same work. And so that's one of many claims being made here, that we're not being compensated fairly. The next claim, and it's not listed like this, but from what I've been able to get out of legal experts looking at documents and the articles that have come out, I've spoken to a couple legal experts. Obviously, it's a legal matter, so it's, you know, it's hard to get anyone from within U.S. Soccer or the women's representatives to speak on this, understandably. But the next one, and Alex Morgan made it very high profile when her status is high profile, her level is world class, and her ability will bring attention when she speaks. Talked about bed bugs and talked about staying in accommodations that were well below that of the U.S. men's team. Flight situations, whether it be the type of seat or the route or other things linked to travel, technical staff, you know, the people that prepare you to succeed. And in the modern day, this is a big group. I haven't been on the men's national team in a really long time, but now as a club owner and someone working in the game, it's incredible how advanced the support and technical team is behind a soccer club, whether national or club level. And their claim is that they are not supported in a fair way. They're not supported anywhere near how the men are. And that has competitive disadvantages. But more importantly, legally, the federal court should change that based off of laws that are supposed to keep this from happening. And that's when it gets into an area of outside of compensation, which should be an easy thing to calculate, but is going to be very complicated. There are other examples of discrimination based on sex. So the gender of this team, they believe if they were a different gender doing that job, they would be paid much differently. And so what I want to try to do is try and at least form or point out straw man arguments to get rid of them, because I think a situation like this is going to be very delicate. It's very difficult. You know, for me, being a progressive person, I need to be careful not to get in my echo chamber and not hear the entire argument. I also can't have confirmation bias based on what I wanted to do or what I thought they deserved if I would have won the election. But before we get into some of these arguments, and I'd love to kind of hear you help us, you know, shape this in the right direction to try and outline what the women's national team position is and what we expect the response to be from U.S. Soccer. I think what's good is to read the some of the written statement. Now, Carlos Cordero came out with a statement
just to lay out the timeline. So again, this was the lawsuit was filed on March 8th. And Carlos Cordero tweeted this statement on March 15th, so a week exactly after the lawsuit was filed.
Yeah, thanks. So, and obviously a prepared statement, and we've seen these from time to time from U.S. Soccer, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. You can go to you can go to Carlos Cordero's Twitter account. You can go to U.S. Soccer. You can see the statement in its entirety. But there was just a few things I pulled out that I thought need to be discussed. One was obviously they feel that this claim is without merit, and that they haven't shirked their responsibility and haven't broke a law, and have reached a fair and equitable situation with the U.S. women's team. And the letter starts with. Instead of a compassionate statement or a support of that idea, it starts with a defense by listing all the things that they've done recently to help grow the women's game and support them. You know, increase investment in programs, partnerships with groups, high performance staff. Charter flights have been changed to improve travel from time to time, and they've chartered when they didn't before. And so, some of these things may be true. And I guess what's difficult is even if you improved, what they're saying is it's not fair. So it's just how far have you improved? But the things that I wanted to point out that I think get to an important discussion here, he said in addition, and this was after listing all of the merits and all of the changes that have been made recently, and many of these before Carlos Cordero was there. So let's just for a second, I feel strongly and will be critical of some of these things. You know, he's new in office, so he's inheriting some of these issues. And that's a challenge for anyone. And, you know, he's trying his best to figure this all out in this seat. I don't think he's doing a great job of it, but I'll use fact rather than emotion about that. So in addition, this is Carlos Cordero in a statement. In addition, U.S. Soccer believes that all female athletes deserve fair and equitable pay, and we strive to meet this core value at all times. Essentially he's saying we strive to meet it, but really what he's saying is we're there. I mean, you know, maybe that's just semantics, but, you know, we strive to meet this. So, you know, he's essentially saying this is wrong, which you would expect a statement where you're getting sued to be. We don't agree with this. This didn't happen. But it's just the language just is not, it's not clear enough. And it's not it doesn't really make you feel confident that that's going on by just saying, you know, we strive to meet that. We believe in that and we strive to meet that. Just say, you know, and he couldn't say this because there are claims that they're in it. You know, the current situation is equitable and fair. You know, we have spent a lot of time making sure that our women were treated the same as our men, and they are. But of course, they don't go as far as that. But that's what you wanted. You wanted two things: either here's my stance, we have been fair, or you know what? If there is an issue, and I'm new in office, and I'm trying my best to get U.S. Soccer on the right track. And, oh, by the way, he ran on an equal pay platform for women. We're going to address this. We're going to get to it. But it felt a pretty defensive statement. And I'll bring out another line in it. While we believe the current agreement is fair and equitable, so eventually gets on to that after several things. While we believe the current agreement is fair and equitable, we are committed to working with our U.S. women's national team players and understanding specifically where they believe improvement is needed. I just find it hard to believe that those conversations haven't happened. So it shouldn't take getting sued to find out your employees are unhappy. I would hope, and maybe this is either a political posturing and a lawyer putting together a statement that is noncommittal in any way, but I would just hope that one or two things are true here. One, this is true, and you're going to push to finally understand why the women feel they're not being treated fair and why they're unhappy as one of your greatest assets and one of your most high-profile groups that make the Shield a very proud and an emblem that is consistent with prestige and success. I mean, the women's national team has given us that. You would think as someone that oversees that asset and that group, it would just be a bit defensive. And if you're truly searching that, it begs the question, what sort of structure do we have where this is coming as a shock to you? You know, we're not on the inside, but I can just look from the outside and say, I bet they don't want to play on turf. You know, I probably don't need a committee or a meeting or a lawsuit to know that the men don't. So if the men don't play on turf, how do we put the women on turf? And we should probably talk to them. We should ask their coach. And I got into this during the election when I suggested sometimes decisions are made not the right way and not for the focus of competitive advantage. And I used the example of the U.S. men's national team playing in locations that were very close to large populations of groups that support, celebrate, and will go and cheer on the team you're playing against in a very, very highly competitive and high stakes scenario of qualifying for a World Cup. Instead of going to Columbus, Ohio, which becomes a very difficult place to play, and you're more than likely in this very multicultural, which I'm not saying for a second, this isn't xenophobia. We're a very multicultural and beautiful and colorful country, but decisions that have competitive focus, you wouldn't play in some of these stadiums. That is a revenue decision. And the next thing is, if it's a competitive focus, you wouldn't put your world-class athletes that you're hoping prepare themselves well to go and win another World Cup or Olympics or, you know, the many things that our women go off and win, you wouldn't put them on turf. I mean, no one would do that without asking first if they want to do that. And so another thing from the outside, I think it's clearly not equitable that the women's national team are preparing for a World Cup. And the World Cup is more challenging than it's ever been because other countries are starting to focus on, invest in, and support their women's national team like we have in the past. And the other countries and nations are catching up and are reaching this incredible level that our women have set. And so with that on the horizon and the men's national team without a competitive game for quite some time, well after the World Cup, it begs the question, why were resources, time, and money spent to find a U.S. men's national team GM, but were right on the cusp of and months away from a Women's World Cup, and you still don't have even a shortlist? I mean, we haven't even heard if interviews are going on. So, you know, things like that from the outside, I don't need to ask the women's national team players, the former players, the current staff. I don't need to ask any of them if that's good or fair. It's pretty clear from the outside it isn't. So all of this will beg a question. Why do the women only earn 38% of what the men earn? Why do they fly on planes that aren't as nice with connections when the men would go direct, on fields that are not as good, in hotels that aren't as good, with not as many masseuse or doctors or nutritionists or, you know, trainers? You know, all of these things that we know to be true, and the women have at times been telling us this is the situation, how do we justify that? And I think ultimately the suit comes down to that, that's the crux of this suit. The disparity is real, and we see it. Now, the tough part for the women in their case is, in the Equal Pay Act, a comparison of work is a calculus that's done. So it's not, I play soccer for the U.S. women's national team, I play soccer for the men's national team, I get on a field, you get on a field, we get paid the same. You know, it doesn't work that way, and no workplace works that way. There's a calculation done, and the calculation needs to start with what does a female soccer player who represents the U.S. men or the U.S. women's national team at the highest level, what does she get paid to play in a friendly? What does the men's side, what does a male get paid to play in a friendly against similar competition, right? And then and you have to find that unit. So we need a baseline of what are we starting with? Forget all the nuance of is it a qualifier? Is it a friendly? Is it on a weekday? Is it on a weekend? Is it in a big stadium? Is it in a small stadium? Is it prime time? Is it not? Is it the actual first team versus other players? You know, is it World Cup year? Is it not? What are the rankings of teams in a competition? How many nations actually participate in qualification for a World Cup? How many people watch said games? All of those other calculations create a really difficult apples to apples comparison of work. And I think a lot of time will be spent on trying to find this point where these things can be compared, because the disparity is real, but the disparity isn't illegal if U.S. soccer can justify said disparity. Now, I don't think they should fight to justify it, right? I'll go back to that. I think I'm just disappointed that the statement from U.S. soccer wasn't, you know what, it doesn't matter, you know, if we have the legal right to compensate our women the way they're being compensated, or put them on that plane or on that field or in that hotel, it doesn't matter if we have the legal right to do that. We commit to not doing that anymore. And that will start with this World Cup, and let's forget all this distraction and get behind this team so we can support them to go do it again, because it's getting harder and harder for them to do that. And some of that's on us. We need to find a way to make their competitive advantage grow. But before we get into all that, we're saying right now, it's all over. They're gonna be paid the exact same amount the men are to represent this country. That's what I wanted, but obviously that's not happening. So now we have to delve into some of these discussions, and just my hope, and that's what I'm trying to set right now. My position is clear, right? But it's important to offer counterarguments, because you can't have discourse without that. So I think it's good to just, maybe from your perspective, mm-hmm. let's go into some of these areas where we think there's a strength in a U.S. women's national team argument, and try to at least create the posts of where U.S. soccer is going to come in on that.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, from kind of viewing the story from the outside, I'm curious to see how the U.S. soccer is going to defend itself. And we've kind of seen that the first step with this statement from Carlos Cordero. There's a good article on Sports Illustrated by Michael McCann that kind of gives a comprehensive summary of this whole situation. It kind of outlines both cases for the U.S. women soccer and for U.S. soccer.
Can we put that in our comments?
I'll put the link on the description for the
perfect
podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Put it in there so people can get to that article.
It's really good. And you know, the thing I find interesting is just how U.S. soccer is going to try and defend itself here. And one of the first defense it brought up was, irrespective of the merits of the players' legal claims, those claims are extinguished by the U.S. women's national team and USSF collective bargaining agreement. In April 2017, the two sides announced they'd ratified a CBA that will run through 2021. This article goes on to say, expect the USSF to argue that other than a four-month window at the start of 2017, when there was no CBA, the U.S. Women's National Team players and USSF have been bound by a CBA during the relevant time period. Therefore, the USSF will contend that lawsuits related to wages are preempted by a CBA. And just to follow up back then, so this is from the article.
Mm-hmm. This is a good place to start.
Because in Carlos, in another thing from that statement from Cordero, he writes, let me just pull this up here. Specifically, in April of 2017, we agreed to a fair and equitable collective bargaining agreement with the women's national team, which included a contract structure that the players specifically requested to provide them with a guaranteed salary and benefits. At no point since that time have players raised concerns about the CBA itself, and we continue to work with them in good faith. So he's basically gone to that exact defense that Michael McCann here predicted they would do. And then the second defense that he brings up that I find interesting is that the U.S. Women's National Team's wage calculations are misleading and lack appropriate context. The USSF will argue that any disparity in pay reflects market realities and consumer preferences rather than USSF discrimination. While the U.S. Women's National Team is undoubtedly more successful than the U.S. Men's National as a team, the global market for men's soccer is more lucrative and thus arguably warrants higher wages. The USSF could acknowledge that that this disparity might reflect sexism on the part of soccer fans, but it could also contend that it is not responsible for such sexism. That's just an interesting couple arguments that this article is saying that U.S. soccer could be making.
Yeah, so let's tackle a couple of those. So let's start with the end and work backwards to the CBA. Mm-hmm. So because you prefer to watch a men's game over a women's or a women's over a men's game does not make you sexist. Mm-hmm. But what he's getting to is if there's any market indicators, ratings would be one of them, right? If there's any market indicator that whether it's attendance or ratings or merchandise purchased that is tied to revenue that changes how much we pay the men versus the women, then the market's sexist and that's not our fault. So this doesn't have to be true or false for the women's claim to have veracity or not, right? So I think there's for sure truth to the fact that you could prefer a men's game to a women's game without any discriminative emotion, without being sexist. But the fact that you do, or that you even know it's on, or that it's even in your town, or that it's set up in a way that makes it appealing. And this goes to sort of the Title VII, you know, promotion and support of that. You know, there are sexist mechanics behind that maybe you're not making a conscious decision to not want to watch women's soccer or men's soccer, but decisions are being made for you to make it less attractive or less likely you're going to be interested in watching women's soccer. So, I mean, yes, that's true, of course. I mean, but you can't pass the buck on this one and say, well, listen, because, you know, the men, and like here, let's use hard numbers, and not hard because ratings are not the most accurate, right?
Yeah.
But the most watched soccer game in U.S. history is a women's game.
Mm-hmm.
So don't say for a second there isn't a demand for the sport or there's an interest in it, right? I watch the women because I support the U.S. women's national team, and I watch their professional game because they're players that I love watching, just like, you know, I watch MLS, not because I'm behind certain clubs, but because I kind of like to watch individuals. I've never been like a team guy. I love watching certain players. Like when Tobin Heath plays, I'm fine in that game. I mean, she has a quality about her play that is so entertaining to me, and it doesn't feel any different than when I watch you know, when we were watching Mbappe, you know, in the Champions League the other day, like she makes me excited and I'm incredulous and glad I'm watching because she has this incredible skill and irreverence and she likes mm-hmm. to take people on. But someone might not find out that Tobin Heath has that because it's not being put in their feed. It's not being put on their TV between the things they already watch, reminding them it's coming on. It maybe isn't put in a stadium that has an environment. You know, watching Mbappe play in an empty stadium is not the same as watching Mbappe play where there's an incredible atmosphere going on, especially when it's the type of player that gets a crowd going crazy like Tobin Heath does. So, you know, there are all these things that show you the market definitely votes. I mean, in so many ways. We vote with our wallets. We vote with our eyes. There are many things we do as consumers to vote, but it's the game is rigged. We're not voting for the men's national team or women's national team based off of the same type of support and promotion, and that's the case. So they need to justify that. So U.S. Soccer needs to combat this, not by saying the market's sexist. We're not. They need to combat it by saying the reason we only spend X on promoting the women and this is what we spend on promoting the men is because of these factors. And that has to be satisfactory. So that needs to be part of it. We don't put them in these stadiums in big cities that are expensive, or you have to underwrite a lot of the cost in prime time and you know the rights packages. All of these decisions that make it less of a big event, you know. The reason we do that is because of this. I mean, they need to justify that because there are times that the women are playing in areas that you wouldn't put the men in, on fields you wouldn't put the men on, in time slots you wouldn't have the men in, on networks that are not compensating for that product like they are for the men. So all of these things need to be justified. And if the justification explains the disparity, and that's satisfactory from a legal perspective, there isn't a case. But there are so many disparities. It's going to take a big discovery that's going to, I think, possibly if this continues on, it will shed the most light and create the largest transparency we've ever seen in U.S. soccer history as a traditionally opaque organization that has pretty clear conflict of interest that have never been explained. And so that was a part of this last election, and now that's kind of coming to the surface again. And let me use numbers. So the Women's World Cup did what? It was 2015. So
the 2015 final was USA-Japan. 25.4 million on Fox.
I mean, incredible, right? We cover one of the biggest leagues on the planet. That is a monster number.
And just 1.7 million on Telemundo. So you're talking about total just over 27 million in the U.S. watched that game based on those numbers.
Now, and so there's one other game I had you look into. Mm-hmm. This is for me, not supportive of an argument, but just helps to highlight the complexity and the nuance of an equal pay suit. And it's going to be difficult to navigate through the minutiae and all of these rabbit holes and strawmans and things you can get lost down. But the men, their largest, I mean, the largest watched game in this country was what before that game?
It was USA-Portugal, which was the group stage of the 2014 World Cup. It had 18 million on ESPN and 6.5 on Univision. So almost, 24.5 million total. The thing to note there, so again, that World Cup was played in Brazil, pretty close, similar time zone to the U.S. That game was on a Sunday night at 6 p.m., so prime time. So that really helped bolster that number because people might be wondering, well, U.S. made it out of the group stage. They played Belgium. That game was on a Tuesday at 4 p.m. Still got a pretty good number, though, 16.5 million on ESPN and 5.1 on Univision. So, and what's interesting, and this is, I gotta be careful with hypotheticals, but if the U.S. had won that game, they would have played Argentina on a Saturday. And I don't know if it would have been prime time, but it makes you wonder if they got, if they had 18 million for a group stage game on a Sunday, you get it on a Saturday, a game against Messi and Argentina in the quarterfinals, the final eight of the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be interesting to see what that number could have been.
And so here's the thing. The men for a group game got a number close to what the women got for a World Cup final. And so there's an argument that, listen, the men aren't going to win a World Cup. And listen, they're not going to win a World Cup in my lifetime. I mean, it's possible.
Know.
It's possible. But like the challenge on the men's side, not even double digits teams that have won the World Cup on the men's side. How many teams have won the World Cup?
So you have the top of my head. So Italy, Uruguay, Germany.
Brazil.
Brazil, Argentina.
Spain.
And Spain and France. And I think that might be it. Am I forgetting anybody else?
And And the nations where it's the number one sport and how long men have been playing, you know, it is a serious, serious challenge to all of a sudden come from a kind of nowhere nation. I mean, 1990 was the first World Cup the men qualified for.
They did play the 1950.
I mean,
the modern day qualification process.
Yes. So, and listen, it's become easier and easier for us to qualify for World Cups.
I just want to say one thing. I forgot one big one that we would probably get hammered for by our colleagues. England also won World Cup. Yeah. eight total. But they
omitted that one for some reason. I couldn't think of that one. But you know, the broken logic, like bad accounting here, would say the men getting to a World Cup final would do an enormous number, right? And then the other thing is the men not winning a World Cup is you can't say you're measuring that against women, the women's team winning World Cups, just because this gets into the nuance of just like the rating isn't fair, right? Like, what time zone is in? You know, what day of the week is it? You know, how much was it promoted? What all of these other things that move the needles and change the dashboard, it's just not possible to do an apples-apples comparison that's linked to success. But the women's claim, I totally get and feel, which is, listen, let's just talk within success in our realm. Like, forget before you compare it to men, but you know, what are college coaches compensated in the women's game versus professional coaches and all of these other things that, you know, their claim that we won World Cups and the men haven't is not a provocation. And listen, there's a lot of unity on this issue. You know, a lot of us know one another. I over the years have talked to a lot of these players, and before this was even coming out, a lot of us on the men's side were like, this, we totally don't agree with this, and we think they should be making the same as us. But when you get into the nuance of comparing their team to the men's team and you try to use success metrics, it just doesn't work that way. And that's why sport's so hard, because, you know, in this workplace, you don't take performance disparity from a standpoint of something that's linked to anatomy, you know, because whether a player is good or not is not about if you're fast or strong or can jump high or run, you know, or run long distances or any of these things. I'll tell you that when I've played in games, and I do this with Street FC all the time, our female players in Street FC are better than the guys tons of the time. But because I've gotten rid of athletic disparity by shrinking the field, and now we see that get rid of that, and you're going to see some skillful players like crazy. And I used to at UVA, I would run a pickup game all the time, and Lori Lindsay was the first person I'd invite because she was better than so many of the guys on our team. You know, when you shrink the field down and you get rid of the disparity that makes it not an apples to apples comparison. And by the way, that's dropped over the years. I mean, you know, the women's team now, the disparity isn't anywhere where it used to be, but you can't get lost in these straw man arguments, because it I think distracts from the foundation of the argument that the ratio of support, the ratio of investment, the ratio of compensation is not fair and equitable. And we're telling you that. And it's going to be hard to measure it, because you get to all of these things that end up being straw men. You know, like ratings. Ratings is not a good market indicator. And we use them all the time. And obviously, it's super important to try to grow ratings. But when you try to compare ratings for a college basketball game on a Wednesday to a soccer game on a Saturday morning, it's tainted data. It's not going to spit out the information you're looking for, and it's not really going to be helpful. It's kind of a fruitless exercise. To put things in context, it's important, right? Like all of these things, how successful the women are, the ratings for that World Cup, all of it in context is incredibly important. But I think you have to get rid of these things to get down to, we are not being treated fair and equal. And I believe that based on what I've known for a long time. I believe that based on what I learned during the election. I believe that based on what I've watched recently, and the GM position is one of many examples. I don't think you can say, we believe it's fair and equitable, and put them on turf when you don't the men. You can't say that. That's not fair and equitable. And if you're putting them on turf and it's based off of the revenue they generate, show us why they generate revenue that's so much lower than the men that they don't get to fly on the same planes, play on the same field, and stay in the same hotels. Like, that's more what I'm interested in, because some idiot's going to say, well, you know, if they want equal pay, let's make one team and see if they make it. And, like, that idiot's going to, you know, this phone that we have, it's just, I saw it during the election, you know, idiots have 5 accounts apiece, and they're anonymous, and they're there to spread vitriol and distract. So I just... I don't know. I don't have any legal basis to understand where this is won or lost, but I just mean, in the court of public opinion, let's not go down these rabbit holes of what would happen if the men and women played each other and all of this nonsense that totally distracts from the fact that we should all be concerned to begin with. The default reaction for everyone should be, these are our players. They are... world-class players. They are World Cup winners. They are gold medalists. They are, they give us joy. They give us pride. They give us entertainment. They give us aspiration. They don't feel good right now. They don't feel they're being treated well right now. The default reaction to their suit should not be, you're getting enough, or, you know, you couldn't make the men's team. All of that we have to mute and get rid of and get to. First, let's truly listen and understand why they feel this way. So don't start with your argument. Don't preempt their expression of their need and their expression of their disappointment and resentment and discontent and pain. Don't let them do that first. So let them talk about, here's what's going on, here's what we need. You know, we want to succeed, and we think this is fair. So that gets us to collective bargaining agreement. So U.S. Soccer is going to say, and as you said, Carlos Cordero kind of has already, well, you didn't say it was fair when you agreed to the terms, right? That again, I'm no legal expert, but is a bit of a straw man argument. So you said it was okay, and now you don't. I just don't think that holds up for several reasons, but I asked one legal expert to give me their opinion on it, and they said, well, listen, being in a union, right, so the players' union agreeing to things, and listen, we've had this on the men's side where the players' union made a decision that shocked all of us in the league or covering the game, or even the people, by the way, that were in that union that were representatives there voting on the same situation. Just because a union, which represents a group of workers, votes on something, it does not take away your right as an individual to say, there's an issue and there's a federal law that protects me from being in this situation. And as an individual, I don't agree with the CBA taking that right away from me. So I just don't think the CBA thing holds a lot of water, and we'll see. But, you could easily get into the difficulty of understanding this is a complex situation, in that U.S. Soccer also subsidizes the professional league, right? And the men had the same situation where U.S. Soccer and MLS and a media company and a marketing arm, Soccer United Marketing, it's there is no division between church and state. So there's some of that that's really good, because bringing in money, even if you didn't earn it, but your league or your club or your individual is not a part of the group bringing revenue in, you can use that to subsidize, to get something over the hump and to give it the investment and to give it the security, so that it can grow and it can thrive. So it's a complicated situation, because U.S. Soccer does help do that for the U.S. women, but it doesn't matter. you know, that arrangement does not take away your right as an individual to say, working for this company, which, again, it's strange that we're talking so much about profit and revenue, and it's a 501c3, but, you know, I digress and say, it doesn't matter what the arrangement is or what the collective bargaining agreement says. I can come forward as an individual, and there are 28 of them, saying the treatment I receive as an employee in this company is not fair and equitable, and there are laws that say this is not allowed to happen. So, I mean, I guess maybe discovery you know, the thing about this is it could take years to play out.
Yeah, well, I was going to actually bring that up. Hope Solo filed a pretty similar lawsuit to this just on her own August of last year, and that case is still pending. So we have no idea how long this could take. The other thing I want to note, too, is there hasn't been any indication that there will be any sort of work stoppage or anything like that. The U.S. women haven't threatened to sit out of the World Cup or anything as of now like that. And it doesn't look like there will be anything you know, serious like that, which would be obviously very sad and disappointing if something like that were to happen.
But you're alluding to a problem. So if I work in a company and you've got to, with your union, come up with an agreement. You know, my work life cycle is not as dependent on events coming up quickly. It's not as competitive in terms of the spot that I have, and also, you know, as I said, you don't have time because you know players retire after 10 years. So in this small window, and especially in the women's game, where a lot of our greatest female soccer players retire after college because the opportunities aren't there. And so this case is just a much bigger thing. If you just pull yourself out, don't get angry, don't be emotional, pull yourself out and see the big picture. Ultimately, Title IX was a mechanism that U.S. soccer didn't create, right? But a mechanism that pushed resources and attention towards female sports and helped in a way, and in a big way, for the U.S. women's team to become a world power. And fortunately, we've been able to support those gains and protect them with investment. But the investment hasn't been enough. And I think, especially if you look at the youth side of the women's game, we're not the powerhouse we used to be, and the pipeline's not as good because a mechanism that pushed investment there was not U.S. soccer's investment. It was a cultural paradigm. And so we need another cultural paradigm. And there isn't another Title IX coming. So U.S. soccer coming out and saying this would be a version of that, to commit resources towards the investment of the game where our greatest players have opportunities outside of college. You don't have to be 22, 23 years old in the prime of your career and go find a job somewhere. You can go into a professional league. And so we've seen some women go abroad, but there needs to be a domestic professional league that supports that career. And that's a part of this case too. You know, part of what we're talking about is opportunity for women. And the national team performing well, it inspires, it encourages, and it should support a system that opens up opportunities for young girls to one day be a professional player, a professional ref, a professional coach, a professional club owner, a executive, a technical director. All of these positions should, of course, exist in the men's world for women, and we've been way too slow to open up opportunities for women outside of players in the men's soccer world. But within their world, we have to create more opportunities. And so this case is kind of a call to action on that too, to say, you know, this isn't about these 28 players. And it's very brave of them while they're still representing this country, which, by the way, you know, it is a scary thing. And I'll tell you, as someone that's challenged U.S. soccer, it's a scary thing to come in and everyone has this in their workplace, and be critical of the person who employs you in such a competitive world. That's courage, you know, and they go on the field and impress and wow us constantly. And now they're doing it off the field. And I'll say that about Hope Solo. You know, I knew Hope from being young and being in youth national teams together. And so, you know, the attrition rate, when you're coming up through the youth national team levels, not many people start at under 14 and make it all the way up. And she and I kept surviving the next iteration, the next group, the next team. And so, you know, there's only a few players that you knew on both sides when you were in camps together or in tournaments together. And Hope was one of them. But I never really got to know Hope very well, you know, coming up through the ranks. But I got to know her better during the presidential election. And I think people make an opinion of, you know, they have their mind made up about Hope based off of mistakes she's made in her life, that she's admitted, and we all have. You know, I mean, it's, you know, people in glass houses, right? It's like you can't step up and be that critical of someone without understanding what they've been through in life. And Hope is that perfect example of someone that divides opinion. But I saw a brave, intelligent, obviously successful, but humble enough to not make it about her and her career. I mean, the fight going on right now that Hope has been fighting at the end of her career and now through the presidential election where she stood up is again, feel however you want about Hope as a person. And even if your opinion, and most people will have an opinion that is based off of information without ever meeting her or speaking to her, and we all do that all the time, and it's a bad practice to judge people you don't know, but have that opinion if you need it. But I just you need to see someone fighting for everyone coming behind them, someone not fighting for themselves. You know, I tell you, it's not easy what she's doing, and it's not getting her friends in the world that can open up doors for her. She's doing this to open up doors for others behind her and fighting for what's right in the game. And that's what these 28 women are doing. And whether they win or lose, whether they're right or wrong, whether this is settled or goes all the way, I just think that's what we need to see. We need to see incredible athletes that I can't tell you how hard it is to get to the level they're at. I mean, it is incredible. The character you need to make it where they've made it, and then to go even further in the world and win and beat the other best that made it up their pyramids. I can't tell you how hard it is to do that, and the character it takes, the discipline it takes, the selflessness it takes. And this lawsuit, for me, is demonstrative of what I've always seen in the women's team. The 99 team, I was so jealous and envious of the camaraderie and the togetherness that they had, because the men's national team, you know, it was a more cutthroat world. I mean, it was a tough place where you didn't feel that super team bond. But like, I remember those commercials. Remember that commercial? And it was great, where Brandy goes in to get, you know, at the dentist. I don't know if you remember this one. We might have to put this in the comments.
I'm not sure if I've seen this one. Yeah.
Too, with the article. But Brandy, I see it in my head. But so Brandy goes in to the dentist and comes out with the dentist, and he says, you know, she needs two crowns or something like that, you know. And then I think it was Mia and maybe Scurry. I can't remember who was in it, but they all one by one stand up and they said, I'm going to get two crowns or whatever it was. They like each said, no, if she's got to do it, I'm doing it too. And I think it was a Nike ad, and it was just so, it's just so demonstrative of what I'm trying to get to, which is this unity, this togetherness, this willingness to fight, this willingness to take something on, this willingness to push the envelope, to shift the paradigm, to leave something better than the way you found it. I've always looked at the women's national team that way. I've always seen them like that. And like, do they have cliques? Do they have their people that, you know, divide opinion and all that? Yeah, every team does. But I mean, that's a team. Mm-hmm. And you know, this looks bad. This is bad for everyone. I mean, U.S. Soccer being sued by a foundation and by one of their teams is bad. It's bad for everyone. Mm. But the 28 players that are stepping forward to do this, I just hope, and I can only imagine what some of their mentions look like and, you know, some of the vitriol they're facing. I just hope everyone sees, you know, wait and let this play out. You know, don't make your decision right now, but just start from a place of complacency. You shouldn't want anyone to feel this way. And also see it as, this is why they're successful on the field, because they're scared of nothing. They believe in themselves and they come together for a common goal. So, you know, I hope we've done enough to try and shape it into a place where there can be some good discourse, but it's a tough one. It's not a black and white scenario, and you could feel how you want to feel. I guess this is an easy one for me because I want to go a step further. You know, I want them, if the men get paid a dollar, I want them to get paid a dollar. So it's easier for me because I don't need to be convinced, but there are those that, and some of them legal experts and judges in a federal court that have to hear a case and be convinced. You know, time will tell if the information we get, if the discovery gives the jurors and the people who will deliberate on this enough to say yes or no. Mm-hmm. But it's just, I don't want to live in that zero-sum game where we've got to wait for years with disgruntled and upset employees who have to go and perform. I just don't want to wait for years for them to get what they deserve. And if they deserve what they have now, I promise you they should get more. I just, you know, like, that's kind of how I feel, and that's the only personal side of this I want to inject into this. But it's important that we have the right types of conversations, because even my level of access to people and information that you guys can help me find, you know, I still don't have all the facts, and I just wanted to make sure we got on the air today, and this podcast was important. And I do this from time to time where I feel very strongly about something, but I just wanted to make sure more than anything else we didn't misinform. And we tried to just provide information so people could go away and have good discourse and discussions about this.
And I think just to wrap it up, you know, you've already touched on it. I think what you want U.S. soccer to do or expect U.S. soccer to do, but you've touched on also that this process could be very long in the legal system. I guess the question I have is a two-parter. Could you see U.S. soccer trying to handle this, resolve this relatively quickly on their own, you know, kind of put aside the lawsuit? And if so, you know, what would be the first step or next step you'd want to see them do?
So I expect that's already started. I would think with both U.S. Soccer Foundation suit and this one, there's conversation behind the scenes. I think Cordero even alludes to it in his statement where let me see if I can find it, where he talks about meeting with players. I think he says, I want to assure everyone in our soccer family that U.S. soccer and its women's national team players remain partners with shared goals and aspirations. For that reason, we are very optimistic as to what is possible, and our commitment to reaching a common ground is absolute. And then he goes on to talk about meeting with veteran players. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find the part that says, oh, here it is. To that end, on Wednesday, I spoke with some of the veteran players to better understand their thoughts and concerns. Our initial conversation was open, cordial, and professional, and we will continue to work to resolve this matter. I hope that's true. You know, I mean, I think this is something right now based on the current situation where what I would do, I would say, let's quickly come up with, because we have a huge tournament coming up, what would we do if they were male? Just that, that's it. I would sit all of my people that make decisions, I would sit them at the table, and I'd say, we got a very, very big tournament coming up. Our job, we have many jobs, but one of our responsibilities as a member services organization is to help put a competitive women's soccer team on the field to represent soccer in this country in a way that makes us proud, but also gives them a competitive advantage to be as successful as possible. So that's what we're supposed to do. That's the charter. Here we are. What would we do, simple question, if this was the men's national team? And whatever that answer is, I want the entire operational plan. Like, I want to know cars to the airport. I want to know seats on the plane. I want to know routes. I want to know hotels. I want to know security. I want to know technical staff. How can we beef up and support their group without disrupting it? Because the other thing, you don't want to throw things into the system right now, because I'll tell you, a group, we're not just the players on the field. That extends huge. I mean, it's a village that supports these teams. So without disrupting that, let's come up with a list of everything. What's doable right now? Now, we just got done this past election bragging about our surplus. That was one of the big arguments of let's keep the people in charge in charge. We have all of this money. So you got a lot of money. So you could probably pull this off to say, let's just for the time being support this team and not see gender and get them through this World Cup with the promise that the second this World Cup's done, after your parade, we get together and we hash this out. Here, who are the people that you think need to be in that room? Okay, here are the people we think to be in that room. Let's sign a term sheet. Let's sign a term agreement saying at no later than, you know, May whatever, this date, give you time to celebrate, give you time to relax, give you time to regenerate. At no later than this point, we get together to figure out where we're missing here. Do that, announce that. Like this thing that I'm reading now, this statement that says, what do you mean we've done everything? Here are all the great things we've done for these players. By the way, it is fair and equitable. But by the way, you know, we totally want to work with them and make sure they get what they want. I mean, there's a lot of contradiction in this that could have been saved by, and I bet you this is like the 25th draft, right? Like, I'm sure they put this through a lot. Mm-hmm. And listen, I can understand that part, but the meeting that didn't happen, or at least didn't come up with the right conclusion, was this statement should say that. You know what we're doing? We're suspending the CBA in terms of we're going to sign a freeze of this. And by the way, you can do this. It's the same thing I did when I ran for U.S. Soccer president, and NBC was supportive of me going for my goal, but they couldn't have conflict of interest, so I could no longer be an NBC employee while I did that. And essentially, I said, well, I'll sign something saying I'm not, and I won't take a salary. I won't be an employee. I'll go. And that was the right thing to do, and that gave me the ability right out of the gate in the election to say, I'm an unemployed person that cares very much about soccer in this country fighting for this job. This statement should say, we're signing a freeze of this current CBA. Here are the terms that are going to get us to the 31st. Basically, in terms of national team, we're just taking right from what we do for the men. So it's pretty easy. There's no negotiation. We're just doing that. And then after that point, right when they get back, after the World Cup final, that agreement goes back into place. I think you said 2021 it's in place for. And we sit back down at this point and discuss things. Now, if at that point U.S. Soccer hears it out, right? Like that's what Carlos Cordero said. The surprise to me, like they just agreed to this. Let's sit down and hear it out. If they hear something new, right? Like if that's new to them, they hear something that changes their mind. Well, then if they want it fair and equitable, then they should be okay tearing up the CBA, which, by the way, you can do and start a new one. If they don't, then this goes on, right? If they don't and they say, sorry, we just think it's fair and equitable, I guess the next step would be U.S. Soccer the U.S. Women's National Team players and their representatives could say, well, show us all the information that helps us understand why this is justifiable. That's not readily available. That could be an impasse. But, you know, I don't want to get in this situation where we all are checking in, you know, after the World Cup or before their next World Cup and all of these and just saying, you know, where are we with this? And also, I don't want, you know, the news and everything that's going on in the world, you know, you get fatigued by so much that you need to care about and so much that's important. I don't want this to get lost. I don't want a very, very important situation for our women's national team players to just get lost in the shuffle and for attrition to have it slowly go away. If I know anything about U.S. women's national team players, the ones that I know, the ones that I've become close with, the ones that I watched, the ones that I watch now, they don't give up. So if they think they deserve more, if I'm a betting man, I'd bet that they don't fatigue. I think that they go the distance. And so I just don't think it should come to that.
I think that's pretty good point. Probably yeah. A good place to end it, I think.
I don't think I can say anything more than that.
You're clearly passionate about it. And I think it's all well said. So
yeah, I mean, you know, I'm also I'm grateful that NBC, obviously, I'm an employee too, and to a certain degree, they can They can hold me to a conduct and to a standard in here. And I love that when we've had moments where I really feel passionate about something that kind of falls outside of my job description, as long as I do it in a fair, balanced way that is information-based and doesn't alienate and doesn't try to it's not a provocation to try and upset groups. You do it in a way where we create positive discourse. That's all they ask for. And so, I'm just glad that we get a chance to talk about something that's so important. I mean, I think before we're on Premier League and we have our meetings and we watch our games, and I think one of the reasons that our team has been so successful is before all of that, we're just soccer nerds that love this game. And we all, we all talk about all of these things all the time. So, it's good to be able to feel passionate about something that from whatever pulpit I have, I can express that and hopefully get other people to send this link on to others, send the article that we're going to put in the description onto others, and just don't let this conversation go away. Let's keep it positive. Let's keep it fact-based. Let's keep it, there's nothing wrong with being upset and angry, but we have to just make sure that it doesn't become noise and, the right message isn't heard. So that was the message for today, Tad Potter. So, not only do that, but of course, especially when it comes to standing up for something, if you believe in it, stay on your feet.